Thanks for coming to SEJ 2024. Who's excited for hydrogen? My name is Reed Frazier. I'm a public radio reporter in Pittsburgh for a show called The Allegheny Front. We broadcast on public radio stations in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and occasionally our stories make it out onto the NPR network. So thank you all for coming. I will keep my remarks brief because I'm sure you guys have a lot of questions about hydrogen, as did I. When I first started covering it, I texted my colleague at the Post-Gazette, the paper in Pittsburgh, who covers this kind of stuff, and had written lots of stories about hydrogen already. And I was like, I'm going to have to learn what hydrogen is, aren't I? And she was like, yeah, you are. If you were like me, you were only vaguely aware about hydrogen as a potential clean energy replacement for dirty power sources. But in the last few years, there's been a lot of changes with the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. That's all starting to change. There's a lot of money starting to pour into this nascent industry, and a lot of us have a lot of questions, potentially billions in federal subsidies to stand up what is essentially a brand new industry in some ways. We'll get into some of the details in a minute. But there are also lots of questions surrounding clean hydrogen and lots of critics. One of them is in the front row. I'll just... Full disclosure, he called it a pain in the ass to work with in my bus tour yesterday. Joe Rome, find him later. There will be a lot of new infrastructure if this happens, and that, as we know, can always impact people who live in frontline communities close to these facilities. And it isn't certain at all if the incentive structure that we are currently setting up as a country is going to do exactly what we wanted to do. So to unpack all of this, we have a great panel today. I'm looking forward to speaking with everyone and having you guys ask them questions. And I've lost where we are. First, to my right, we're joined by Julian Spector. He's a reporter for Canary Media, who's covered lots of clean energy topics like storage and batteries, and has been on top of the hydrogen story from the beginning. In a little bit, we'll have Mark Clincy. To his right, Dave Edwards is the director and hydrogen advocate for Air Liquide. Did I say that right? French. And Air Gas in the United States. Dave is responsible for partnerships with industry, academia, and government. He's been with Air Liquide for 25 years. Congratulations. And his company is involved in several of the hydrogen hubs awarded by the Department of Energy late last year, including the one right here in Philadelphia called the Mid-Atlantic Clean Hydrogen Hub, or as it's called, Mach 2. You might hear that phrase later on. That's what we're talking about, Mach 2. We also have Sienna Teluxing to his right. Sienna works at the nonprofit Rocky Mountain Institute. Over her career, she's worked with large-scale solar panel manufacturing, off-grid residential solar and storage microgrids. She's worked in several countries, including Dominica and Mauritius, and with several governments of Caribbean nations. Right now, she's heavily involved in helping companies come up with business models to incorporate clean hydrogen in their decarbonization plans. We also have another panelist who is on his way, I'm told. I will reintroduce him when he comes in, but he is Mark Clincy. He's with a group called Philly Thrive. It's an environmental justice group here in Philly that has been working a lot on issues with fence line communities. We'll just stop there, and when Mark comes in, I'm going to have him go sort of down that aisle, so if y'all could just be aware. So we are going to start with our friend Dave Edwards here. Dave.
Yes.
Start with some basics. like, what is hydrogen? It exists. We make it. What do we make it for, and how do we make it? Go.
So I could spend my career talking about that, but the history of hydrogen, so if you go back to the Big Bang and we start 3 minutes into the universe. Sorry.
Just speak closer to the mic.
Speak closer to the mic. So after the Big Bang, 3 minutes later, everything was hydrogen, or nearly everything. But we'll skip to the modern uses of hydrogen. Just recognize that hydrogen is a molecule that's been used in a lot of different applications for many, many decades. Right? In the U.S., hydrogen production is mostly aimed toward things like ammonia fertilizer production, things like desulfurizing petroleum products, so used in refinery processes, used in a lot of specialty chemical applications like metals and semiconductor manufacturing. And for 70-ish years, companies like Air Liquide have been producing that hydrogen mostly from fossil fuels, so taking mostly methane molecules or similar hydrocarbons, splitting those in a thermochemical process to produce the hydrogen, which then is distributed in a number of different ways, mostly through things like pipelines or through compressed cylinders. But we can also cool it down to cryogenic temperatures, liquefy it, and ship it by truck. But we're not here today to talk about the traditional hydrogen production. We're here to talk about how hydrogen has a role potentially in the energy transformation. When we think about it in energy transformation, we have to look at the environmental footprint of hydrogen. And so we're talking about hydrogen from low carbon sources or in production methods that reduce the carbon footprint of that hydrogen.
So Dave, let me stop you right there. How is it currently made, and why is that bad?
So currently, in most cases, we take a hydrocarbon of some sort, put it into a high-temperature catalytic environment, and it splits it from, for example, methane, CH4, produces carbon dioxide and hydrogen with the injection of water and some other processes in that. But essentially, for every kilogram of hydrogen that you're producing, you produce about 10 kilograms of CO2. And that's more or less the way that most of the hydrogen in the U.S. has been produced for industrial applications to date.
So what's bad about that?
Well, obviously the 10 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of hydrogen. But you have to recognize that that's only one of the ways to produce hydrogen. The other common way to produce hydrogen is to take a water molecule, apply electricity across that molecule, split it into hydrogen and oxygen. Essentially, the oxygen is released back into the atmosphere, and it produces hydrogen at the point of production with zero carbon emissions. If your electricity is also zero carbon, meaning it's coming from wind or solar, then you have a true zero carbon energy carrier. You have that hydrogen as an energetic molecule with zero carbon. If we go back to the first processes of using hydrocarbons, there are things you can do to decarbonize that as well. You can look at the feedstock and replace things like natural gas and other hydrocarbons with renewable feedstocks like renewable natural gas from landfills or from dairy digesters or from wastewater treatment, for example, and that decarbonizes the process. You can also look at how you could capture the CO2 from that process. Because the CO2 is a concentrated source, you have the potential for carbon capture and then storage or reuse of that CO2, for example. So in both cases, there are ways that you can reduce the carbon. Some of them are renewable, some are not, and gives you a portfolio of production methods.
Okay, thank you for that great explanation. I'm going to move to Sienna. So there's like a color code, right? Of hydrogens, clean hydrogen. Well, all hydrogens, right? So can you just walk us through the basic? I know there's like magenta and turquoise, but just give us like the primary colors here so we can just have a intelligent conversation.
Sure, thanks for the question. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, just speak close to the mic, that's all.
How about now? Thank you. So thanks for the question. So the color spectrum of hydrogen is really a first-order indication of the production method. So if we think of blue hydrogen, for example, blue hydrogen is really the production method that Dave just explained, where a fossil fuel feedstock is split into hydrogen and carbon dioxide with a fossil fuel energy source, and then blue really means that carbon dioxide out of the stack is captured and stored. Green, on the other hand, is symbolic of a different production process where renewable energy is used to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. So if we think about the color spectrum, it's really the production method, but there's no indication of the carbon intensity of that eventual hydrogen that's produced.
And can you walk me through, like, what are the best cases? Like, why are we talking about this? Like, what are we going to use it for potentially that would be beneficial from a climate perspective?
Sure. So as Dave mentioned, hydrogen is used extensively in a wide variety of industries today, from refining to chemical to fertilizer production. And if we can offset that high emission hydrogen with low emission hydrogen in a one-to-one way, that's a win for the environment. But hydrogen is a very reactive and energy-dense molecule, and it's very versatile. It can be used in many more industries to decarbonize. So there's great potential for hydrogen to be used in shipping, as a shipping fuel, as aviation fuel, or as an input to aviation fuel, rather, and for steel manufacturing. Traditionally, all of the industries, which are very crucial to our daily lives and the running of our economy, are fueled by fossil fuels. And if we can find new application for hydrogen and its derivatives, that's a win for the environment, and it can be done in a cost-effective way.
Okay, great. Just want to acknowledge my our next panelist, Mark. We're going to get to you, but Mark Clincy is here from Philly Thrive. I got a question for you in a second, but we're going to come to Julian now. Julian, you have been reporting on this probably longer than anyone, or potentially about as long as anyone has. The bipartisan infrastructure law created 7 hydrogen hubs. It's like the Lord of the Rings. 7 hydrogen hubs there were. But you went to one of them in the Gulf Coast to report on this. Explain what happened, what is the hydrogen hub concept, and tell us a little bit about your reporting in Houston and what you found.
Absolutely. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here and filling up the room and everything. Very exciting. I went down to Houston in December to see kind of the emerging hub there. We should say the Department of Energy selected 7 different regions in the U.S. last fall to receive this total of like $7 billion. None of the specific projects are actually locked down yet, because there's still a kind of ongoing negotiation process to finalize that, and then there's going to be a lot of community outreach, and so there's still a little bit ethereal, but like, we know who the major players are. Air Liquide is involved in like 6 of the 7 ones, so you sort of can see who the major corporate entities and legacy energy companies and community groups are. But the idea with these hubs is that for this all to work, for the clean hydrogen vision to become reality, you need a mix of production and distribution and storage of the hydrogen and users all kind of clustered geographically, because it gets extremely hard and expensive to project your clean hydrogen across long distances. You'd have to either build these pipelines and worry about it kind of leaking out, or you need to liquefy it and transport it, and that's energy intense and can be expensive. So there's a lot of value in like producing it close to where it will be used, and that's already happening in Houston because of all the refineries and the petrochemicals. So I wanted to see kind of like how is this existing major hub of hydrogen production getting ready for this cleaner hydrogen future. And it really is an exciting time down there. Like, there's kind of a boomtown atmosphere, and you have people really across the whole Houston energy industry getting very excited about this, lining up billions of dollars of private investment. And there's a whole gamut of different types of ideas. So, you know, lots of people trying to do the carbon capture because they already know how to make it with methane, and there's lots of methane, and they think that the carbon capture makes sense. You can do that at scale. And then, of course, they need to actually figure out the catching it and sequestering the carbon for it to really be a clean solution. And no one's really done that at the commercial scale yet in Houston. But then there's another whole group of people that are basically lifelong renewables developers, you know, experts at getting wind and solar built. And their approach is, hey, Texas has great sun, great wind. Why don't we tap into that with lots of renewables and run electrolyzers off that Texas renewable energy? They think that will ultimately be the most cost effective, and that they can kind of beat out in the carbon capture folks in the marketplace, because eventually, you know, renewable energy keeps getting cheaper, and the electrolyzers are going to keep getting cheaper. Was that too loud?
No, it's a little. They can hear you next door, but that's okay.
Oh, they can hear.
Hey, exception to the rule.
Yeah. I used to do theater. They taught us to project. So I mean, I just thought it was a very interesting time, because you hear concerns about hydrogen, that it's maybe a front for fossil fuel groups, and you know, Chevron, Exxon, folks like that are involved in the hub and contemplating different aspects of the hydrogen economy. But I think it's important to recognize there's a whole range of approaches, and some, you know, many of the people getting involved are very dedicated to clean energy and very experienced at getting clean energy built. And there's some exciting ways where you can even build that in an off-grid way and sort of get around all these constraints on the transmission grid that is a real barrier to large-scale renewables elsewhere. So now, importantly, like, basically none of this actually exists yet. It's all highly theoretical at this point, but, like, as I'm sure Dave can explain, you know, like, all the pieces have been tried at some level. It's just kind of tying it together at this massive industrial scale is like the fundamentally new thing that needs to happen.
Great. That's a good segue into my question for Mark. Mark, you, yeah, if you can.
Thank you.
You live in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I was interested just to have you start by telling me how you got involved in Philly Thrive and what role, you know, heavy industry plays in where you live.
Okay, I got involved in Philly Thrive for 7 years ago. I was very much interested in Philly Thrive because of what they were doing for our community. Philly Thrive is helping the community. One of the big things we did, we shut down a refinery in South Philadelphia, that's been polluting the air for 154 years.
Wow.
And I mean, you had, where I was living at, Wilson Park senior citizens apartments and homes, you have senior citizens that have died from cancer, have respiratory illnesses, they've had problems with their sight, lung diseases. It was gotten so bad they couldn't even go outside because in the summertime it would be just bad.
So that's your experience with, and it's very close. Like, how close was it to, like, where you live, this refinery? How close was PES?
I live in the fence line of two blocks from the refinery.
Wow.
So I know. It's bad.
And so you're curious what's going to happen to that property there?
Well, the property is now owned by Hilco. And Philly Thrive, I know there was a tour yesterday of the Hilco plant. And our complaints with Hilco is, number one, they want to build a life science center, and they want to build a warehouse, but they have not cleaned up the refinery.
Okay.
You got toxic waste, chemicals on the land. Covering it with concrete just doesn't work.
Right. And have you been able to tap into the discussion about the hydrogen hub in Philadelphia?
Yes, I have a little bit. I went to a webinar about that, And I haven't had a chance to listen to how others felt about that. And I dropped some messages in the chat about that. And I understand their concerns about this hub, because there are things they're not telling the community. Safety concerns. When we, there was this person from Chester, Pennsylvania, who was they're already fighting against the trash burning plant out in Chester. I'm sure you've heard about that. And having built these hubs on the I-95 corridor, I'm talking Delaware, Pennsylvania, Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Vermont, Maine, it's just not good. It's not very well thought out. You're talking about hydrogen gas going through the former pipelines of the refinery, pipes that are old, haven't been cleaned in years. So what's going to happen to the waste material from the hydrogen gas?
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, they don't tell us. They're talking about non-disclosure act. That's not acceptable.
All right. Dave, I want to swing this question over to you. I know Mr. Clancy has concerns about, a lot of people have, frankly, have concerns about, like, not knowing what's happening with these hydrogen hubs. Maybe you can walk us through what's going on with these hubs right now and why the detail, like there's no real details or information that is, you know, people want to know yet. So talk us through that.
Yep, and it's quite understandable. There's not been a lot of information because there isn't a lot of information to project yet. But I'd like to take a step back. You introduced me as being active in the Philly hub. We're actually not. We were part of the organization that helped put that together, but we don't have any active projects there, so we're not part of the negotiation process specifically in this region. We are in four of the others. We have active projects, and we've engaged with most of the other hubs in some form or another. So broadly, we are involved in a lot of the different hubs, just not the ones specifically here from a project perspective. But the hub process, there was an award made. And it actually wasn't awards. Awards is actually the wrong word. There was a selection of seven regional hubs to negotiate for award. And negotiate for award means find the right partners, find the right regions, find the right kinds of projects, and put together the structure which we're going to work together in these regions. It means bringing the companies that are going to make investments. It means bringing the regional government and agencies into play, bringing the permitting authorities, bringing the community representatives, bringing labor representatives into the discussion early to understand what kind of partnerships we can form. That's the phase that we are in right now, is negotiating essentially what that partnership, public-private partnership, will look like to execute the hubs. I don't exactly know what the date is going to be, but in the next quarter, we anticipate that we'll sign what's called the cooperative agreements, which is the structure under which these groups will work. That kicks off the actual project. And the first phase of the project, which will be between 12 and 18 months, depending on which hub, will then be to define which projects, which locations, what communities are affected, what organizations need to be involved, who from the community needs to be in the discussion. That happens after we'll sign these cooperative agreements. So recognizing that a lot of people have a lot of questions right now, those questions really will be answered in that first phase of engagement. That's the intent of the program. Right now it's a matter of putting in place the structure under which we'll operate. As you can imagine, with these very disparate groups working together, the complexities, the legal requirements, the things like who owns IP, what are the processes going to look like, how does the DOE involved, how are other agencies involved from a state and local level, very complex processes that we're working through right now.
Thanks. Sienna, I want to swing the question over to you now. Dave talked about it, complexities. What are some of the, let's just talk about the technical or economic hurdles to working with hydrogen, like, why don't we have this right now? Like, what's so hard about this?
Well, at the end of the day, it's an economic problem. It's not so much a technical problem, but I can deconstruct the economic problem in a couple different ways. So the first is that hydrogen, to create hydrogen from water, you need energy. You need energy, and that comes from renewable energy, ideally. However, we don't have that much renewable energy to power our load right now. It's renewable energy take about 10%, contribute to about 10% right now. So a challenge that we face is including more renewable energy into the grid, and that costs money. And it also involves overcoming transmission constraints. So that's the first challenge. We need more renewable energy. The second is financial institutions are still risk-averse when it comes to investing in clean hydrogen projects. While hydrogen itself is not a new molecule, the production process is new, and that comes with technology risk or perceived technology risk. So the cost of capital can be higher compared to traditional ways of producing hydrogen. And the third is emissions accounting. As I spoke about before, we have the rainbow of describing hydrogen that really does not account for the carbon intensity of the produced hydrogen. Not all hydrogen molecules are made equal from an emission point of view. So what we really need is a standard framework to capture the carbon intensity of the hydrogen molecule, and once we have a transparent framework, we can compare one hydrogen supplier to the next and get a good idea of the emission footprint, and that will help buyers make investment decisions on where they're sourcing their hydrogen from so that their eventual products are very clear to the end consumer of the carbon footprint. And the trends are very clear. The EU is already setting up a framework for accounting for emissions. The International Maritime Organization, which governs international trade, is setting up a framework. They're in active discussion for emission accounting. But until that becomes clear, there's some hesitation for investment in clean hydrogen.
So I'm going to follow up question for you. So you work with companies that are interested in this. What do they want to know? Why? What do they need to do, like clean hydrogen, green hydrogen? What are you telling them?
Good question. So different companies have different questions, essentially. But one of the main questions is, how do we design a green hydrogen project so that we can ensure that our carbon emissions are as low as possible, and we're also eligible for the tax credits that have just been announced? Another question there are, what's the demand for the product like in the future? And it's not just hydrogen that they are seeking to produce, it's hydrogen derivative molecules, which are methanol and ammonia. Currently, methanol and ammonia come from fossil fuels, and they're used in the chemical industry for car dashboard, for mattresses, for fertilizer. And if we can replace gray hydrogen, so gray is another color, and gray is unabated fossil fuel produced hydrogen, if we could replace gray hydrogen with green hydrogen, the price tag goes up, but the carbon emission goes down, and we help companies evaluate the market outlook for the new derivative molecule.
Okay, Julian, I'm going to swing the questioning to you now. Tell us about the... People are skeptical about this when we're handing out billions of dollars to oil and gas companies, potentially, to solve the climate crisis. That's going to raise some eyebrows. I know a lot of people in this room are, I can almost feel it. So I want you to just walk through there's a bunch of things, right, that people are worried about. Just give us a list, and you don't have to go into too much detail, but just what are some of the things?
Yeah, so... Oof, man, there's a lot of, there's a lot of burden of proof on this because it, you know, it's been talked about for decades at this point. It's been kind of the next big thing in clean energy for many, many years. My colleague Eric Wessoff used to do an annual tracker of the 10 most or top five most profitable hydrogen fuel cell companies publicly traded. And it was always a great article to write because it was an empty set. There was never any single profitable publicly traded hydrogen fuel cell company until recently, like someone in Europe kind of cracked it finally. But so it's, you know, it's been an industry where there hasn't been a lot to show for all the talk of you know, solving these entrenched problems. Specifically, you know, I think on the carbon capture side, the big elephant in the room there is like carbon capture hasn't worked very well at all in the power sector. And so, you know, for all these projects that it's been talked about as a thing that could, you know, get rid of all those emissions, when you try putting that on a smokestack of a coal plant, it's never worked very well and it costs a lot of money. An important distinction in the hydrogen case is there's a much more concentrated stream of CO2 coming out of the steam methane reforming process than a smokestack in a coal plant. So there actually is good technical reason to think it's you'll be able to capture more of the CO2. I think Air Liquide has one system in France where they say it's capturing 95% of the CO2 stream. You know, so it's important not to assume that the failures of carbon capture in the power plant sector will necessarily apply here. That said, you also then need all the pipelines to transport the carbon, and then the projects that'll inject it underground. And again, the U.S. actually has injected a lot of CO2 underground over the decades, mostly for enhanced oil recovery, where it kind of squeezes out more oil, and the oil companies take that oil. But in the process, we've actually put a lot of CO2 underground, and it's stayed there, and there's monitoring for that. So, you know, that no one's tied all of those together in a hydrogen project specifically. So you kind of need someone to do all those pieces together and then measure and sort of empirically show, hey, this is actually doing what it's supposed to do. You know, and it's important to kind of like look for that evidence and make sure that's proven. Then I think probably the main source of skepticism on the electrolyzer green hydrogen side of things is where that electricity comes from. Turns out has a huge impact on how much carbon is emitted. And this one's counterintuitive because it seems like it should obviously be cleaner to use electricity and just run it through water and produce hydrogen that way. But all these recent studies have shown if you're using just whatever's on the grid, you just plug it into the grid and use the general mix of electricity, you can end up producing considerably more carbon than the, you know, traditional process that's just sending carbon dioxide straight into the atmosphere. And so it's like kind of hard to, I found that very counterintuitive, but basically you need a lot of electricity. And the idea is if you're diverting whatever, you know, clean sources we have already on the grid, then instead of those powering the lights and displacing coal, you sort of need to burn more gas to make up for the amount you diverted to the electrolyzers. And so even if you're, say, signing a contract with a nuclear plant that's carbon free, you're then diverting that power that could have gone to the grid. And you know, we still have a 55-60% of the electricity produced in the year is from fossil fuels. So there's a lot of work left to do cleaning that up. And so that's created this whole movement towards additionality and tracking, very like detailed tracking of where your electricity is coming from and does it match when you're using it to make hydrogen. You know, the analysis that ended up in these tax credits from the IRS is basically saying you got to build new clean energy that is producing at the times that you're using it. And if you can kind of prove that, and it also has to be in the region where you actually are, and then you can prove that you're substantively using clean electricity to produce clean hydrogen as opposed to using electricity and, you know, buying a paper credit that says it's clean, but in fact, you're causing real emissions to happen in the meantime.
Yeah. So I actually want to ask Dave about this. I can't remember. I'm going to say the Department of Treasury released the rules or the IRS. I don't remember, but it's out there on the internet, probably in Julian's story. Dave, so these are 45V tax credits. They give companies money for – maybe you could just explain what the tax credits are and why they're important. Like, these could determine, like, how clean this industry becomes, correct?
Very much so. The Inflation Reduction Act has a number of different sections that potentially impact hydrogen and one or two sections that are written specifically around hydrogen. The one that gets most of the attention is Section 45V, which promotes the use of low-carbon hydrogen or the production of low-carbon hydrogen and gives you an incentive on a per-kilogram basis. For every kilogram of hydrogen that you produce that is essentially zero carbon, you can get about a $3 per kilogram tax credit if you meet the eligibility criteria. And then there's a tiered structure going down to about 60% reduction from traditional methodologies that would give you smaller and smaller incentives. A $3 per kilogram incentive is quite substantial. The production of hydrogen, we usually do it on a per kilogram basis. A kilogram of hydrogen has about the same amount of energy as a gallon of gasoline. So a kilogram of hydrogen in a fuel cell vehicle will typically get you 60 to 70 miles of conversion. It's more efficient than the combustion engines. So $3 per kilogram tax reduction is something like a couple dollars per gallon equivalent tax reductions, for example. So it gives you that kind of scale to think about what these numbers are. That can be make or break some of the production methods because it brings a value for carbon. One of the challenges with hydrogen traditionally is that our customers and our markets and the sectors that we're trying to decarbonize don't have a mechanism to value that decarbonization. From an Air Liquide perspective, we're looking at the heavy-duty trucking industry as the first real adopter of low-carbon hydrogen for transportation fuels. And the reason is because the competition with hydrogen is actually diesel and gasoline priced at the equivalent of $6 to $7 per kilogram costs. And now we have a mechanism on a national basis that says if we can produce low-carbon hydrogen and sell it into that market, we have a mechanism to value that carbon on the order of $3 per kilogram if you can do it at zero carbon and meet all the conditions that Julian pointed out, which are quite substantial. There are other places that the hydrogen can be used, other applications. Our focus is around mitigating diesel or replacing diesel and gasoline in those heavy-duty markets, but there's lots of other sectors. In addition to that production tax credit, there are some other credits along that pathway. There are some that address feedstocks. There's a lot of credits that go into wind and solar applications, for example, which doesn't necessarily go to hydrogen, but certainly enables the hydrogen market for electrolysis, for example. There are also some incentives for adopting zero carbon or ZEV vehicles, for example, which certainly could be fuel cell vehicles, fuel cell trucks, fuel cell rail, and other infrastructure projects that are in there. And then the connection between where the hydrogen is produced and where the user is usually a distribution network. For us, we liquefy the hydrogen, distribute it on road, take it to a fueling station that looks a lot like a gasoline station, and then distribute it to those heavy-duty trucks. That infrastructure needs to be developed and invested in, and there are some investment tax credits in the IRA for that as well. On the production side, there's also historically the 45Q, which is essentially for carbon capture applications. So for those hydrogen producers that need carbon capture, there's a mechanism for that as well. So across the spectrum, there are a number of different ones. But the one that gets most of the attention is the 45V, which was Treasury, IRS being part of Treasury, for those rulings.
Learn something new every day, don't you? Well, what about those users? I mean, this is like the chicken and egg problem is very cliche with this industry. Are there companies that are like, yeah, Air Liquide, let's give us the hydrogen and we'll do that?
Absolutely. And it's not a chicken and egg problem. Normally, people think chicken and egg is between the vehicle and the availability of the hydrogen. Well, you can't buy a vehicle until the hydrogen is available, that vehicle will simply sit and not have any fuel. So you must have the fueling infrastructure first. The first movers in this was the state of California in light-duty vehicles. There's about roughly 20,000 light-duty vehicles on the market in California, and I don't know exactly what the count for stations is now, but 40 or 50 stations active in the state of California right now for light-duty markets. We're very much focused on that next generation of adopters, which will be the heavy-duty markets. Think about the large trucks that are going point-to-point or that are servicing the ports. Those are really the big users of fuel and the big the area where fuel cell vehicles really makes the biggest difference. For light-duty vehicles, battery electric vehicles are a great choice for those people that have access to charging. Fuel cells will fulfill a smaller role for those people that don't have availability to charging or need very long miles. But on the heavy-duty trucking market, battery electric is not nearly as good a solution because of the weight of the batteries and the recharging times. And fuel cell vehicles with hydrogen fueling becomes a much better solution for those applications. So that's really the one we're focused on. All of the investments we're making in the U.S. are toward that production, distribution, and support of these new markets. The vehicles are now available. You'll see a number of demonstrators out there, but the producers are starting to make them in quantity off of assembly line productions. They're no longer science projects. The fleet operators are starting to feel the pressure of things like the ACT and ACF rules in California, and now the most recent EPA emission reduction requirements that the manufacturers face for heavy-duty vehicles are all going to drive us toward the need for zero-emission solutions, and hydrogen fuel cell solutions will be a leading candidate for some of those markets.
Excellent. There's a lot of more things we can talk about. I want to get to listener questions or audience questions in a minute. But Mark, I want to go back to you for a second.
Thank you.
Okay. Dave isn't with Mach 2, apparently. I had bad information. It was my brain. But let's just say Dave was with the Hydrogen Hub. You live in a neighborhood that could be host to a Hydrogen Hub facility. Like, what do you want to know? Like, if you were to get to talk to the hosts of the Mach 2 Hub, what would you like to know?
I would like to know, one, is it safe? Because it's not just me. Okay. It's not just me. I mean, it's other people in my community. They're worried. I mean, they've been through enough with the refinery. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that, one, it's safe, that there is no emissions coming out that are dangerous, that's going to make us ill or unhealthy. There's been enough of that with the refinery as well. We want to make sure that we also have a say. As I say all the time, nothing about us without us. So we want to have a seat on the table.
What have you seen so far out of the Mach 2 process?
Pardon?
Like, how has the process gone for you so far, trying to figure out what's going on with it?
What, as far as the hub?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I've only attended one webinar, so I'm waiting to attend another webinar so I can learn a lot more about it. And as I learn more and the community learns more, then we'll decide on what action needs to be taken. Because we are worried that we're being ignored thanks to the Non-Disclosure Act. That's not good because, number one, what are they hiding from us? What are they not telling us? That's something we need to know. And we have the right to know as residents in the urban communities. In Pennsylvania, Delaware, Jersey, New York, we need that information because it may impact our health. So those are the things that we need to know.
All right, I want to open it up to listener questions. Oh, awesome. I'm coming to you. SEJ policy, y'all know, journalists first, SEJ members first. Say your name and who you're with.
Hello, I'm Monica Samayoa. I'm with Oregon Public Broadcasting. I have two questions. How energy intensive is it to make green hydrogen? And is this an actual climate solution?
Everybody hear that?
How energy intensive is it to make green hydrogen, and is this an actual climate solution?
Who wants to take that one? Dave.
So I can address some of it. It is a very energy intensive process. What we're doing is creating replacements for things like gasoline, diesel, and electricity with hydrogen. So by its nature, it's going to be very energy intensive. The process of taking solar or wind energy from the grid and turning that into electricity through an electrolyzer has efficiencies in the range of 50 to 75%, depending on the technologies and on the scales and various others, which makes it actually more efficient than some of the other energy conversion methods that are out there, not as efficient as directly charging a battery electric vehicle. One of the challenges that we're faced with is in electrify everything, quite frankly, the right solution in many cases is to electrify everything that you can electrify. The challenge is that there are certain sectors that are very difficult to directly electrify with battery electric. Either they require some form of storage, or they require off-hour operation, or they have a need that battery electric simply doesn't fill. And in some cases, not all cases, hydrogen is not a silver bullet that solves all problems, but in some of those cases, hydrogen can be the right solution. In a lot of cases, I think of hydrogen in its early stages as a replacement for diesel. Diesel tends to be used in applications that have long running hours, that are generally large vehicles or large applications. And hydrogen with fuel cells actually is a good mix for those, where battery electric is actually not as good a mix for those, for example, especially on the vehicle side. There are other places where hydrogen as a reactive molecule really can't be replaced by electricity. If you want to produce ammonia, you need to react a hydrogen molecule with a nitrogen molecule in some fashion. That can't be done with electricity alone, although you can produce the hydrogen and the nitrogen can be combined with electricity as the energy. The carrier, the reactive molecule, must be hydrogen for that process, for example. So in general, we hear comments about it's not as efficient as others, or it's very energy intensive, or these are really big concerns that we need to address. Absolutely, they need to be addressed. But hydrogen does provide solutions that can be zero carbon, that really is difficult to do with other solutions in many cases.
And I'd add to that, the energy intensity, it's a big electrical demand. I think the largest green one that is actually an Air Liquide one up in Quebec is like 20 megawatts, right, of
don't
demand.
Think it's the biggest anymore.
It might not be the big. They're getting bigger all the time, but you imagine, say, like it could be a couple hundred megawatts of electricity demand for a very large electrolyzer place. Nothing like that exists yet, but that's the scale people are talking about. So, it's a lot of electricity. There's also a water element because you need water to zap water with electricity. And so a lot of the developers I spoke with in Texas are very adamant to point out they're getting non-potable water. They don't want to be in a position where they're diverting drinking water from communities in the desert, because that would be bad on a number of levels. You do need a water source that you can then filter and purify, and you need a lot of electricity. And that's why in the places where you would need to work with the utility and go through very expensive and time consuming grid upgrades, that can be a huge barrier to this happening. Which is why many of the renewable developers are looking at just going off grid and kind of making your own electrical island, basically, that can funnel all your electricity straight into the electrolyzers.
Yeah, and just so you know, if you're running an electrolyzer off of the grid, there's a lot of coal and natural gas on the grid. That's bad. We don't want that. We want solar panels or wind or nuclear, if you're cool with that. There's also, I just want to add before we wrap up and everybody runs, I put a bunch of resources in a comment on the Whova app. If y'all are interested, there's just like some resources, article from Julian that you can look up, and just some other resources that I put out there with additional information. We're not going to get to everything, but More questions. Let me go to Elizabeth over here. You're our next contestant.
Elizabeth Roy, Yale, E360. This is kind of a naive question about distribution and end users, but you make the hydrogen, it has to go into a fuel cell, and then the energy goes into a battery, or does the fuel cell go in the vehicle?
So in a lot of ways, you should think about the fuel cell, which is onboard the vehicle, replacing the battery that's there on a battery electric vehicle. So a battery electric car and a fuel cell car are both electric vehicles. The energy is stored in the form of a battery in the first case, stored in the form of hydrogen in the second case. The electricity is produced in the fuel cell. It's kind of a reverse of the electrolyzer. Electrolyzer, you put energy in and you get hydrogen out. A fuel cell, you put hydrogen in, you get electricity out. And so it's a form of an onboard battery, for example.
Yeah, I'm Eric Schmidt, St. Louis Public Radio. Can you talk, Sienna or Dave, can you talk a little bit about the challenges of working with such a small molecule and the ways in which the current infrastructure that we have might not be enough to contain it? I mean, I've heard about how hydrogen can escape from, you know, older pipelines or older equipment. And, you know, how much more do we need to build up to be able to utilize this new potential source of, you know, cleaner or greener energy?
You want to take it, or?
I'll take the first stab and pass it over to Dave. So a lot of the companies that we work with have the same question. So we're exploring derivative molecules as the first step. So hydrogen can be converted in or combined with carbon monoxide to create methanol and with nitrogen to create ammonia. They're both energy carriers. And methanol can be used to power container ships and large maritime vessels. Ammonia can be used to create fertilizer or other chemical products. So the first step is to add another conversion to the process to make that hydrogen more stable, but still in the form of an energy carrier.
In general, I think the core of your question is using hydrogen in existing infrastructure, for example, replacing natural gas pipelines and putting hydrogen into those. In most cases, that's probably not going to be viable for a number of reasons. Those pipelines have material compatibility issues that may be problematic for hydrogen, and especially every component of every valve and every switchgear and everything may have some issues. So there are people that are looking at how do you take the existing infrastructure and do conversions. It's possible that some of those lines will be hydrogen compatible, but in a lot of cases it's going to either require upgrades for new materials or it might require things like linings in those pipes, for example. A lot of the existing distribution network for natural gas is old and not well tracked. It would be difficult to do inventories to validate that every inch of that could be safe, for example. I don't anticipate that there'll be 100% conversion of hydrogen in existing natural gas lines in a distribution network, although we might use it for some of the very large pipelines that move from region to region within the U.S. because those are better understood and better controlled and better documented, for example. But I think that is several generations of investment away. Pipelines are a good solution when you have a molecule that's able to be moved interregionally, or perhaps in a very high-density usage area like we use today in the Gulf Coast where it's feeding refineries. Think about it along the I-95 corridor where it's feeding fueling stations for heavy-duty trucks. That is not going to be the starting point for where this market goes. That is generations of investment away. The starting point will be things like what we're planning to do now, and that is liquefy the hydrogen, put it into tanker trucks, and move it around the same way that we move gasoline and diesel to stations today, for example. And in a lot of regions of the country, that is where we will end up with that from a transportation fuel perspective. Pipelines becomes that bigger question of how do you move energy on a much broader scale. And a lot of people are looking at that, quite frankly. But the material compatibility issues, the ability to do a careful audit and to ensure safety would be absolutely paramount to being able to do that.
Okay, go ahead, Julian.
And just to give you a visual, there's a hydrogen developer in Mississippi I visited called Hystor, and they're building a new, you know, renewables off grid and making the hydrogen. And they showed me a cross section of like a basically a PVC pipe that was about, I think, 8-inch diameter. And it's just the kind of thick PVC pipe. And that's what they're planning to use. So, you know, for a new build thing, it's, you know, you could just lay that down. It's not too high tech or crazy, but it's airtight for the hydrogen. But yeah, a lot of issues if you're trying to run it through the old pipes. And I think that goes to Mark's point too about if the Philadelphia one's trying to reuse some of the old infrastructure, that's something you got to really scrutinize and, you know, see if it makes sense to do.
I would like to expand just on the general comment. We've been in the hydrogen business. We as a country have been in the hydrogen business for 7 decades. In that time period, we've developed the safe protocols for handling hydrogen on an industrial basis. As we bring hydrogen into new sectors, as a transportation fuel or as an energy substitute, we do need to develop the appropriate adoption of those industrial standards now into these new applications. And that is being done consistently in all of the sectors that we're involved in. Just for reference, the American Society of Chemical Engineers has formed the Center for Hydrogen Safety, a place where we can conglomerate all of our information and learnings from previous industrial applications and now start to apply those to the protocols for these new application spaces. I would encourage you, if you have issues about safety or protocols or codes and standards, that's a great place to start for some of those references and some of the materials for introduction there.
Okay, so a lot of potentially new pipelines, but it sounds like a lot of there are add-on processes after you make the hydrogen, for instance, making it into ammonia or shrinking it down through cryo, making it cold. That's sort of taking away some of the sort of like efficiency, right? Or no?
So anytime you're doing an energy conversion, you pay a penalty with efficiency. And so you need to look at the net of the entirety of the process and start to look at it from an economics perspective, from an environmental perspective, from a community impacts perspective, and determine what is the right solution. One of the really great things about hydrogen is there's a lot of flexibility with what you can do with it. One of the challenges with hydrogen is it's difficult to move around very effectively. It's very light in weight, or it requires you to go to very cold temperatures for liquid, for example. You have to balance that as you look at that entire spectrum. If we're going to move hydrogen molecules globally, which a lot of people are looking at, are you going to be able to do that as liquid hydrogen or gaseous hydrogen, or should you convert that to things like ammonia and methanol, which have much easier shipping concerns, but they do have the energy conversion issues? As things get bigger and bigger and bigger in scale, the economics might change in ways that different solutions apply at different scales.
Okay. A lot of questions. You had your hand up.
Leila Nargi, I'm a freelance journalist out of New York. Julian, you alluded to part of my question. I'm reporting on water insecurity this year. You alluded to the water challenges. Can you talk a little bit about what the water intensity needs are for producing green hydrogen? Where's the water? Where's the gray water coming from? Where is it going? Do Mr. Clincy and other communities on the front lines have to be concerned about water issues as well? Are there contaminants? I'm curious to know about water.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know if I have numbers off the top of my head for like just, you know, what kind of run rate of water you're looking at. I do know in like in the Mississippi project, Hystar was able to get rights from this river flowing near the site that they're building in, and it's non-potable, but they're gonna filter it. They actually need extra water because they're drilling salt caverns to store the hydrogen in, which is a whole other approach to like storing large volumes. If you drill a hole in underground salt, which exists in the Gulf, yeah, I mean the folks I talked to in Texas, they were able to, you know, secure the rights. That's sort of like you can't really develop your project until you secure the water rights. And so I think they were able to find some source of non-potable water that the community was willing to sell them, like over in West Texas. I think it's definitely like a limitation. You can't be going and building hydrogen in the middle of a desert if there isn't a ready supply of water. And it is substantial. It's like not a It's not a little use of water. So sorry, I don't have more specific on that.
There are actually some really good resources in the Department of Energy that looks at exactly this. If you contact me later, I can give you those references. But it basically looks at not just hydrogen production, but other energy vectors and says what's the water consumption for each of those. That's a good sort of reference point for the different forms of production.
You had your hand up. And we have time for maybe two or three more.
Thank you. Tracy Carluccio, Delaware Riverkeeper Network. When you burn hydrogen, you do emit pollution. So nitrogen oxides are emitted. In the Delaware River Valley, we have we don't even meet minimum air quality standards, federal air quality standards for ozone. So not only are we going to be layering on top of communities who have been already overburdened with nitrogen oxides because of fossil fuel and other sorts of industrial development throughout the entire footprint of Mach 2, but we're also going to be making our ozone problems worse. So when you look at the map on the Mach 2 website, you see that the footprint of Mach 2 includes all the areas that have already been burdened for 100, 150 years by the oil and gas industry and by the chemical industry. How can Mach 2 and how can anybody sit here and advocate that we bring more nitrogen oxide and more explosive dangers, more emissions, more burdens to these communities? They've already mapped them when they're saying they're going to be reaching out to the communities. We want to know, if that community says no, are you going to cancel Mach 2?
Thanks, and I apologies. Thank you, Tracy. We do want to keep our questions to the journalists first. Sam, you had your hand up,
Well, can I add just a quick point on that? Yeah. So that was referring to one of the uses for hydrogen is to combust it in a power plant as a fuel. I'd say that's probably one of the more controversial uses because, like, if you're doing truck fuel, that's clearly cleaner than diesel. If you are combusting it in a power plant, it's a much murkier kind of cost benefit analysis there. And so, yeah, it doesn't produce carbon emissions, but it is a hot thing combusting in the air, and that's creating NOx. So I would just say the hydrogen, there's sort of like a whole debate that needs to happen over what uses are the priority uses, and the Mach 2. Okay, yeah, so.
It's on their website. It's one of the main uses of Mach 2. So you're taking green energy and turning it into pollution for burning communities.
Right, so yeah, so that's an area that definitely there's, different air quality regulations, there needs to be focus on, like, making sure those power plants are not emitting more than is safe and is allowed, and yeah, we didn't touch too much on the power plant usage, but that's very much like a hot topic, and some utilities want to do it as a way to kind of clean up their plants without having to switch off the existing thermal plants. A lot of folks would say that's not the right use, and you should be focusing on renewables that are more cost effective. But yeah, there's more we could talk about that, but I'll let the moderator go.
Okay, Sam, you're up.
Somewhat related question just to air pollution. I'm Sam Brash. I'm a climate and environment reporter with Colorado Public Radio in Denver. I was going to ask about NOx as well, but you covered that. What about hydrogen as a direct pollutant itself? I've read all kinds of things, that it can open up the ozone layer, that it has warming potential itself. Have any of you looked into what it would mean if there was just more hydrogen being emitted as a pollutant?
That's a good one. You want to take a
little? So I can get started. So first off, hydrogen itself is not a direct greenhouse gas itself, but it has the potential for impacting, for example, the destruction of methane in the atmosphere and the effect of ozone, for example. So understanding those mechanisms and understanding the net effect of potential hydrogen emissions is really critical. From a second point, understanding where those emissions are coming from and addressing those, because one, it's an economic loss for those of us producing the hydrogen, but it's also the potential for safety issues or for others, absolutely needs to be addressed. I would say that right now, that is a very hot topic that's being evaluated and being understood. recognizing how to quantify that, I think, is still in development. But absolutely, as we go forward, we will be thinking about what are those impacts on the environment and how do you minimize them. Quantifying it was the real challenge today.
Okay, time for a couple quick ones. Say your name and where you're from, and so throw a question out.
Okay. Hi. So my name is Kaiyang Lee. I'm a student journalist at New York University. And I actually wanted to ask a really quick, maybe not so quick question, kind of moving beyond the United States. I think, you know, we sort of touched on this, but I was wondering, like, you know, in terms of the entire world, like, where does the U.S. kind of stand in hydrogen development? And what would you guys, like, where would you guys say is, like, the leader in developing this as kind of like an energy source?
That's a good one.
Sianna, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question. So I'll take a step back. So fossil fuel, countries that benefit from fossil fuel, you know, they're privileged, if I use that word, to have the resource available to them. What hydrogen does, it can create diversity in who becomes a fuel exporter based on a different resource potential and different resource allocation. So, for example, countries that did not have fossil fuel reserves but have vast sunshine and wind potential can now have the opportunity to develop hydrogen projects and derivative molecules. So it's a good opportunity there. In terms of the leaders, Europe, Australia, and the US are top leads, are leading the industry. But we're all global citizens, and it is an opportunity for countries that were previously left out of the economic race to enter it.
All right. Joe, I'm going to go to you. This might be our last question. Brevity is awesome.
Thanks. I'm Joe Rome here currently at UPenn, formerly the person who helped launch the original hydrogen fuel cell program way back in the 1990s at the Department of Energy. I apologize for that. I wrote the hype about hydrogen in 2004. I would urge people to listen to the interview that Canary Julian did with Michael Liebrich, you know, who said it's almost complete boondoggle, which I would agree with. It also explains why the IRA is disastrously designed. Yes, it is unsafe. Yes, it is dangerous. Yes, it is a very high greenhouse gas. No, it will never beat electric for trucking. It's way behind. You can't beat the hydrogen heavy-duty trucking is never, ever going to beat electric heavy-duty trucking. Just for the record, liquefying hydrogen uses 40% of the energy in the hydrogen. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I think that I just urge people to seek out the critics. Saul Griffith, very good. Michael Liebrich, very good. I'm always around. Thank you.
Is there a question?
Joe Rome here. The question is, how does hydrogen compete against electricity? The going from electricity to hydrogen back to electricity, you're going to throw away 75% of the original electricity. How do you ever make up for that in the marketplace?
So from the simplest perspective, if you can use battery electric, you should use battery electric for the efficiency reasons, for the cost reasons, for a variety of other reasons. But it won't solve all the solutions. I disagree with you on the heavy duty, and especially on things as they get larger and larger and heavier, especially things that get used 24/7, which is a lot of our logistics infrastructure in the U.S. Those sectors will be very challenging to be cost-effective and efficient with batteries. And so you need to look at the utility of the outcome, not just the efficiency of the energy use. And hydrogen provides solutions that battery electric won't provide in some of those markets. It won't solve all the problems. It's not going to solve all the problems everywhere. Things like school buses and mail trucks and other things that have limited operations or limited miles or limited hours during the day, very clearly those should go to battery electric. the 24/7 port operations much more challenging for those big, heavy trucks that are moving things to the Inland Empire of warehousing, for example.
All right. I want to end on time so you guys can get coffee or whatever you need to do. I want to thank you guys so much, Mark Clincy, Sienna Tiluxing, Dave Edwards, Julian Spector. Thank you guys so much for sitting and educating us.